This is Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio. I'm Ryan Warner. Time for our regular conversation with Governor John Hickenlooper. We're going to do things a little differently this time. For the last month or so, we've been asking what questions you have for the governor. Many of you have joined our Public Insight Network to share those questions and concerns. And on today's show, the governor is going to answer some of them. Governor, thank you for being with us.
Oh, glad to be back.
We've gotten questions, even some suggestions for you, and themes certainly emerged. We heard a lot about state employee pay and benefits. We're going to talk about that shortly. We also heard a lot about fracking, the process of injecting chemicals deep into the ground to free up oil and natural gas. Lots of people told us their fears of those chemicals contaminating water. Here's a question from Philip Davis. He's a farmer who lives in Hotchkiss, Colorado, on the Western Slope.
What do you say to people of Garfield County who believe that fracking has polluted their groundwater and resulted in serious diseases? What do you say to the people of Mesa and Delta counties who depend on a clean environment, who feel powerless against big oil, and look to their state government to balance the scales and to protect our environment, and who are confident that the environmental impacts of fracking are not adequately understood at this time?
Multi-part question there, but what do you say?
Well, there is a great deal of fear out there about fracking. People don't understand it. They're concerned.
Is it justified?
I don't think so. Again, having spent 5 years as a geologist and really looked into this pretty hard, there was a number of stories in the New York Times. We can't find examples in Garfield County or anywhere in Colorado where fracking has gotten into groundwater. Now, there are a number of occasions where oil companies have been careless or made mistakes and frack fluid has gotten into a stream or a pond, gotten into our water. And my opinion is I think we should be even more vigilant and increase the fines on those things. But the fracking itself, what you're doing is you're pushing a dense fluid with minute grains of sand and silt into the formation. So the formation is already under tremendous pressure, but you're pushing this fluid out there and pushing open these microfractures. They're very, very small fractures. And then the silt gets in there and holds them open. So then when you stop pushing, all that frack fluid comes back up the pipe again. It doesn't sit there out in the formation. So the vast majority of it, 95% of it, comes back up the pipe. And most oil companies, the good oil and gas companies, use it again. So they're recycling that water. They're not wasting it. And one of the things we're doing in Colorado, and the Colorado Oil and Gas Association announced a month ago, that we're going to do a baseline water sampling program. So before anyone drills a well, we're going to measure what the groundwater is and look at the chemical analysis of it. And at regular periods after that well is drilled, if it's fracked, go back and measure and look at that water quality again just to make sure that there is no communication.
Communication, you mean between the fracking fluid and water?
Yes, no communication between exactly where the frack fluid has been pushed into the formation and that somehow that didn't get up around the drill pipe and get into groundwater. We're working aggressively with the oil and gas community to convince them, push them, that all the components of frack fluid should be revealed. They are at the well site now. We want to put them up on some sort of a website. And right now, about 90% of the companies drilling already do that voluntarily. So I don't think there's too much reason not to go ahead and get everybody to do it. And then doing this baseline water sampling is really going to allow us to make sure to prove to people that there is no polluting of groundwater from fracking.
So you've got the baseline water testing. How soon would that go into place?
That's in place. They're starting it right now.
Okay.
So to speak.
And then the separate issue, which is disclosing fracking fluids, that will be a state rule, correct?
Yes.
And the question is, how strong will that rule be? They vary from state to state.
Well, our expectation is that this rule would be full disclosure. Some states say, well,
full if there's public disclosure or just to the state?
There are several different ways to look at it. My preference, again, I think this is a question of public trust in the oil and gas industry. And I think most of the companies that do a lot of exploration in Colorado already post this publicly, right? People can go and see what the components are of everything that they put into a frack. I mean, Wyoming reveals all the components of a frack.
Yeah, one of the strictest rules.
Yeah,
would Colorado look like Wyoming's?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a goal that we should move towards.
And when would that be, that rule?
You know, again, I think it's more powerful if this comes from the oil and gas industry. So we're not demanding it. What we're trying to suggest is that the oil and gas companies the Colorado Oil and Gas Association come to, the Oil and Gas Commission, which is the state body that oversees the implementation of rules and regulations around oil and gas in Colorado, and comes to the Oil and Gas Commission and says, we want full disclosure to be required. That hasn't happened yet, but I think there are more and more oil and gas companies that recognize that this is a good thing for them, that we have so much natural gas here. Fracking allows us to get that gas at a very low price.
It sounds to me like you were saying you want the regulated to come to the regulator and say, we want to be regulated.
Absolutely.
People are going to hear that and say, that's ridiculous.
No, it happens all the time.
The regulator is the one that cracks the whip and says, this is what you will do.
that's the way, if you want to continually deal in adversarial environments, that's the way to do it. But
it is an adversarial relationship between the regulated and the regulator, isn't it?
That's not true. We have industries come to us all the time. One of the issues we have to deal with at the state is various industries. For instance, I'm not saying which one is and which one isn't, but say massage therapists or chiropractors, a group of practitioners that at present aren't regulated, and they want to be regulated because they think it creates better trust with the public. Proper regulation should be a partnership between the advocates for public protection, in this case, people that are advocates for all the many, many, many different environmental groups we have in Colorado, but also in the Oil and Gas Commission. They should be saying, well, here's what we think is fair. And there should be a balance, right? It's not just one side coming in and saying, we're going to regulate and here's what we're going to do. You don't want to put a regulation on top of any industry that's going to cause them a ton of red tape and additional cost if there's not sufficient benefit to the public.
I want to go back to one question we haven't addressed from Mr. Davis, again, that farmer in Hotchkiss. It's larger than just fracking, but he says, what do you say to the people of Mesa and Delta counties who depend on a clean environment, who feel powerless against big oil? Well, he's saying something bigger there.
I certainly agree that part of the role of state government is to make sure that we protect our land and water. And he says big oil. It's funny, almost all the large oil companies are happy to reveal all their fracks. It's the smaller companies that resent the intrusion of government telling them what to do, more for political reasons than business reasons, at least in my opinion.
You're listening to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner, and we're having our regular conversation with the governor, John Hickenlooper, and this time we're taking questions from you through our Public Insight Network. Let's move to state workers. Their salaries have been frozen for 3 years. The state contribution to each worker's retirement account has been cut by 2.5%, and the employees are required to make that up, so their take-home pay is actually less. Here's a question from a state employee.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Hall, and my question is, why haven't we been able to have a pay raise? I haven't had a pay raise for 3 years, and last year you guys raised the para 2.5% more out of our checks, which took more of my money away. And I'm wondering, how are you going to be able to fix that? So someone like me that has two children and I'm a single mom doesn't have to work 6 days a week and have two jobs on top of that just to survive and live in a nice place.
Rebecca, we should say, is a mental health technician in Grand Junction at a rehabilitation center for the developmentally disabled. And how do you respond to that question about pay?
Well, Rebecca's right. It's been 3 years of no raises for state employees. And actually, we didn't implement the 2.5% that they now pay towards their retirement fund, towards PERA, that used to be paid by the state. That started under Ritter, but we did continue it. To Rebecca, I think the only thing I can say is we have tried to maintain government services with increasingly dramatically diminished revenues. And we've cut education by some well over $200 million last year. It was $250 million a year before. We've cut higher ed tremendously. These cuts are painful for everyone. And even with all those cuts, we still haven't had resources to give people a raise. And we would love to reward state employees. One thing every week I'm on this job, I recognize and learn more about how hard state workers work. But we're still in a very difficult economy. If you look at architects or construction, people who do pavements, there are many, many, many industries in not just in Colorado but throughout the country where people have not only had a pay freeze for 3 years, but they've taken dramatic pay cuts. Many architects I know have taken 15 and 20% pay cuts over the last 3 years.
Let me say this a bit more indelicately than you have. Is your message, I know it's hard, but be grateful you have a job,
Well, the message is certainly I encourage everyone to appreciate what they do have. You know, we have 25,000 people in the state of Colorado who have been out of work for 2 years. There's some more than 6 million people nationwide. That's difficult. One of our priorities, and I think this should be of every citizen of the state, people want to work. We have an obligation to make sure we get them the training so that they can retrain themselves so that they're ready for these new jobs that are evolving, right? The jobs that are beginning to come back into the economy aren't the same jobs that people got laid off from. So in many cases, we've got to help people get the training so that they can be prepared for new jobs.
I want to play just a bit more from Rebecca Hull, who sees some inefficiencies where she is. This has to do with overtime for herself and coworkers.
How smart is it to offer all this overtime that they give us here? They give us, you can get up to 24 hours a week of overtime. They're paying somebody double the job.
You've been big on finding inefficiencies. Does overtime strike you as one?
Yes, where overtime is rampant. But again, it must be in cycles or very brief periods, because didn't Rebecca also say that she was working two jobs? And if she could pick up 24 hours of overtime at time and a half with all the extra benefits, she'd be pretty wise to do that. I'm not sure what her second job is. It was probably not paying that kind of wage. My guess is that overtime is short for a brief period. Let's say for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, we need to get a bulk of work done, or there's a lot of patients that come into a particular facility. Then we use overtime rather than hiring new people. But if it's something that's been going on for 6 months or a year, you know, we have a website where we're trying to get people to let us know where they see inefficiencies, because folks trying to manage this enterprise, we're not the ones who are going to find the real savings, right? It's people like Rebecca that are actually out there doing the work.
Given the number of state employees we heard from through our Public Insight Network, what we'll do is we'll post a link to that feedback site that
Great.
You've got. So if there are others who see inefficiencies and want to pass them along, they can. We'll post that to CPR.org. Just lastly, on state employee salaries, what would be the threshold or the indication to you that it was time to raise salaries again?
Oh, it's already time to raise salaries. I don't have any argument with that. If you haven't gotten a raise in 3 years, it's hard to be motivated and to really get fired up, unless you look around and say, boy, I sure am glad I've got a job. But still, that's hard. We need to get more revenue back, right? I think if we can begin getting, again, I don't even think we're going to have to get back and replace all the money we've lost to higher ed and to K-12 education and some of the other cuts. But we ought to get close or at least begin to see a prospect, have a budget plan where we can recognize we're going to get there in a couple of years. Giving a raise to state employees is a high priority. You just 3 years, 2.5% pay cut and no raises, that's tough.
You're listening to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner, and Governor John Hickenlooper is our guest. He's taking your questions through our Public Insight Network. Questions and comments, really, as well. This from Regina Jackson. She's a realtor from Denver, and she got frustrated recently when she tried to replace a lost driver's license. She got to the Department of Motor Vehicles office at 10 in the morning and drew number 861 from the machine.
Ouch.
She found that the clerks were serving 735, and they told her that it would be a three-hour wait. So here is Ms. Jackson's question. Why can't workers' shifts be staggered to allow for longer hours at places where citizens go for public services? She goes on to say, this is an easy fix by having a 12-hour business day with staggered employee shifts. What do you think?
I certainly think it's an interesting idea. They tried it in the past, and they found out that they didn't on the what they call the tails of that workday. So either the early hours or the later hours, they didn't have as many customers to keep the people busy. So it
when did they try this?
In 2002.
Okay, and it was at DMV offices?
Yes.
Okay.
So that there were three malls in the metro area: Westminster, Buckingham Square, and Southwest Plaza, and they operated manned kiosks during mall hours. They found that those offices weren't as productive as the other offices. Again, I'm willing to try anything. You know, one thing that people, with driver's licenses, people can now go online and get their driver's license. We can maybe...
That's a renewal thing, not the not a first
right, but a lost license. Like what this woman is talking about, she was told she had to wait in line for 3 hours. She probably could have done this in 5 minutes at her home, just going online. And we need to find a way to let her know that she can go online.
Maybe this is it.
This might be it.
Okay. But the staggered shifts, rocky history.
Yeah, okay. They just weren't found to be as efficient and as productive as what we really need, especially with, you know, in a world of diminishing resources.
You talked a lot during your campaign about getting banks to free up loans for small businesses. And we got a question from Terry Ives. She's a doctor of audiology, working with folks who have hearing problems. She describes her business as a startup business, and she wrote in to ask, the banks in Colorado, even through the SBA program, are not lending to small businesses unless you are already making a huge profit. She tried over 30 banks in Colorado to find a loan with 100% collateral, 20% down payment, and a less than 2% failure rate for the industry. None would give her a loan or an SBA loan, Small Business Administration. She says, you can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make them drink. Does the governor have any plan to help small business or startups when banks won't?
Well, certainly I know exactly how she feels. You know, several years after we'd opened the Wine Coop Brewing Company back in the late 1980s, again, a very difficult recession, and we wanted to expand, and we got turned down again and again and again. You know, when I first started the Wine Coop, I got turned down by 33 banks. So she's at 30. She's got, you know, she's close to breaking my own personal best, my personal record. What's happened is a number of the federal regulations have restricted the way banks look at collateral. So now people need more collateral for their loans. And the sad truth is at the end of these recessions, this always happens. Now, we have gotten a $17 million grant from the federal government that we're using to try and make collateral that is marginal, according to these new regulations, and make it satisfactory. In other words, we provide 3, 4, 5% of the first at-risk money so that a bank knows that if the business doesn't do quite as well but can still keep paying back, the first money that's lost is not the banks. And in many cases, I think that's going to help.
How does that program get accessed by someone?
Probably the Office of Economic Development and International Trade would be the best place to start. You can access it through the SBA.
The money has not already been used up?
No. We just started this a month and a half ago. One of the big challenges is that there are, at least you talk to the bankers, and they think there are a lot of people out there that have good ideas and their business is up and going but hasn't really proved itself, and yet they want to aggressively expand. That was my problem. When we started the Wine Coop, we were doing great, but we'd only been in business 2.5 years, and banks, you know, people forget banks aren't in the risk business, right? They can't afford to have loans not get paid back. So in terms of entrepreneurs, someone starting a new business, it's very rare to get a bank loan.
We're just coming out of August, which you designated as Colorado Proud Month. The idea was to celebrate locally grown foods and agriculture. And so in that spirit, here's a question from Dia Jacobson, a community gardener who lives in Cedar Edge on the Western Slope.
As the cost of gas increases, it's become more important to develop and support local agriculture so people can access fresh produce closer to home. It is healthier for the people and for the environment. So in light of that, how are you working to support small local farms and agricultural producers statewide?
The assumption in that question is that you are. But is that a safe assumption?
That is a safe assumption. You know, we're doing it in a number of different ways. My wife is actually a member of what they call a farm-to-table co-op. So we have a share in a small farm up north of Metro Denver. Every week we get a bushel basket full of all kinds of vegetables, whatever's ripe and fresh. And that's really growing up all over the state. We've also seen a number of small farmers and ranchers trying to brand their food and their meat. You know, I was out in Hayden, Colorado a couple weeks ago, and there's a young couple with two small kids who have taken over the old mill, the old grain mill, and looking at can they do specialty grinding, so, you know, specialty flours, and it would be kind of branded with this West Slope Hayden brand.
And the state support for all this? I mean, the examples you've cited are all grassroots, it sounds to me.
Absolutely. Well, that's the way every entrepreneurial movement starts, right? It's always from the grassroots. And our job in the state, we're not going to go out there and start trying to figure out whether we can make a pecan butter or an almond butter. But what we can do is try and make sure that wherever possible, we can help connect these small entrepreneurs to each other and begin to build a community.
Well, let's wrap up with a lighter question for you. You have referenced your experience as the owner of a brew pub. Here's something from a member of our Public Insight Network.
I'm Chuck Reed from Littleton, Colorado. I'm a local government consultant, and I'm wondering if now that you're more familiar with statewide issues and assets, what new brewing flavor or technique will you bring back to the wine coop that's indicative of the state and the job you're doing as governor?
We should say that you divested from the wine coop, but we like the question. Given your experience so far, would it influence a flavor, a new recipe or something?
Well, that's a tough one right off the top of my head. Although, first, it's worth mentioning that Colorado continues to expand its identity as really one of the brewing centers of the world. You know, the Front Range has become the Munich of the West in every sense. We have 142 breweries now. In terms of names and recipes, the one I like the most that I saw this summer for a light, a kind of a summer approach to beer, New Belgian had a beer called Somersault, and the label is kind of upside down. So what I love about Somersault is that sort of when you go into the governor's office, never having been involved in state politics to a high extent, as the mayor I was involved somewhat, it is like a somersault. Like you do a full flip, and all of a sudden you go all over the state. You meet these incredible people. You learn all these issues in the eastern plains and in the mountain towns, and suddenly it's like you've done a somersault.
Somersault. Then I can't believe you didn't say red tape IPA.
Well, red tape IPA certainly has a future, but I haven't seen anyone make it yet.
Okay, Governor, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Governor John Hickenlooper took questions from people who've joined our Public Insight Network. You can join, too, and help us cover the news. Visit CPR.org and click on the Public Insight Network. Keep your questions for the governor coming. We'd like to make them a regular part of our conversations with him. Michelle P. Fulcher and Lee Hill produced today's show. I'm Ryan Warner. This is Colorado Matters from Colorado Public Radio.